Ante Up is your poker magazine dedicated to the everyday player and their poker rooms. Pick up a free copy at your favorite poker room nationwide each month. But Ante Up is much more than a magazine. Visit anteupmagazine.com daily for breaking news and each week download our award-winning poker cast. Join us on our action-packed poker cruises to exotic destinations and find special deals on Ante Up gear and great poker products at anteupstore.com. Ante Up. It's your poker magazine.
From the WDAE Sports Animal Studios in Tampa, Florida, it's the Ante Up PokerCast. And now here are two guys who think they know how to play poker, Chris Cosenza and Scott Long.
It's July 29th, 2011, and you're listening to the best PokerCast on the planet. I'm Chris Cosenza.
And I'm Scott Long.
Scott, are you still not watching poker on TV, or you know, I know you watch a little of the live stuff, but are you still sort of not watching it?
Technically that's not true. Okay. I just did a little quick weekend trip up to New York and flew on JetBlue, and they have those cool little TVs in the back of the seats.
Yeah.
So I watched some of the NBC Heads Up Championship on the way back.
Oh, awesome.
So I am totally timely on the poker on TV.
Well, I thought maybe I'd give you another
reason. No, I haven't. I've been wanting – I really did want to catch up on some of the World Series stuff, particularly the grudge match stuff, which – but I just – I haven't. So.
Well, you know, I mean, people were complaining that the live, you know, wasn't as good as the regular stuff, and we kept saying, hello, it's bonus coverage, the regular stuff's coming. Well, it came this week. It was those grudge matches. And, you know, those are made-for-TV things, and I'm not necessarily – a big fan of made-for-TV stuff,
right.
And I thought it was kind of weird, you know, the way they did these grudge matches. But the best part was that our good friend Joe Navarro, Ante Up columnist, he's got a regular segment on there now.
I saw that.
I thought it might just be for the grudge matches, but I had a nice little conversation with him via email last night, and turns out that he's going to be pretty much part of every episode. From here on in, you know, even until November 9, and it was so cool. They gave him one of those big John Madden-like telestrators so he could sort of circle what to be looking at on the, you know, and what they did was they would revisit a hand, and Joe, you'd see Joe in the studio with the big screen and the big marker in his hand, or the big, you know, stylus, whatever they call it, and and he's like, you see this here, you see the pursed lips, and he's circling it, and then this usually means that he's upset, he's nervous, and you know, and whatever it was he was instructing, and it was so great to see him in his element, and it dovetailed nicely with live broadcasts. I think if they could get him on the live broadcast, that would be really cool, and it would almost be like a football game, you know, you got your seam here and your seam here, and it goes right up the middle, you know, that's Lombardi there, but thought you'd appreciate that. But I mean, really, I thought that, you know, Navarro's contribution was excellent, and you know, you can read all of his stuff. And you can even listen to him talking about hypothetical situations when you go to the academies or whatever. But to watch him actually break down a hand that he just saw and say, look right here, and it's true. What he's saying is happening is actually happening in the hand. It really made it, you know, that much – really impressionable. I learn a lot more from visual than I do from reading, and I really appreciated it.
Oh, certainly. Absolutely. And when I heard he was doing some segments, it was almost like one of those things like where you say, hey, that's a great idea. And then you start to think – it's such a great idea. How come it's taking this long?
Yeah.
It's almost like a natural.
Yeah.
And you're right. I think, you know, obviously I haven't seen it. You have. But I can clearly imagine what it's like. And I think it would be a much more valuable thing live where, you know, he's a little bit without a net there, you know. Because that's how you play poker. You're in the heat of the moment and you're trying to decipher what a tell, whether it's a tell or not, based on baselines. And I think, I would hope that he would be spot on all of his tells, even in a live format. But it would be good to show how difficult this really is.
Absolutely, absolutely. And like I said, he was spot on, and it was cool. You know, sometimes when you read stuff too, you don't necessarily understand exactly what he means, you know, because it's just, you know, okay, pursed lips, you know, squeezed together or whatever. But when you see it visually and you watch the person purse their lips, or you watch the person squeeze their hands or put their thumbs up or whatever, I mean, it's just so remarkable to see it in play. And he told me that I guess they every Monday he does it and then they air it on Tuesday. So it's like a last-minute edit thing or something. I don't know how
quickly
they turn it around. But, yeah, I don't know if they're flying him to New York. I never got into that part of the conversation, you know, for the stuff, or if they got a studio. But I'm pretty sure they're like, he's going to New York to do these every Monday. That's pretty remarkable to me.
That's great. Well, I'm certainly glad to see him back in the World Series, you know, since the Academy folded. And we weren't sure, you know, exactly what he would be doing in poker. So
I told him he needs to put an anti-up patch on, too.
And then the conversation stopped.
Yeah, that's exactly true. I never got another email from him after that.
Well, you know, if he doesn't want to wear the patch, maybe at least he can pimp the 2011 Poker Podcast Awards for us on the next broadcast. A site called checkraise.com. That's checkraise, R-A-Z-E.com.
Yeah.
We are one of the nominees for this year's awards, and we're up against only 18 other shows, Chris.
You know, it's remarkable that there's that many poker shows. I thought they were dying, not multiplying.
And you know what's even funny about it? You know, up against 18 other shows, and you're like, wow, I didn't know there were that many. In order to even be nominated, the show needs to be available on iTunes and, quote, produce good content regularly. So we're already dancing between the raindrops.
I mean, do you really think that all 18 of those shows produce good content regularly? Oh, my God.
We don't even, and we're one of them, so.
I know voting is up until, what, August 15th, I think?
August 15th. I think they're going to honor the top five shows in descending order. Voters can only vote once, but you can vote for up to five shows. But I know that sounds a little confusing, so let me clarify it for you. Annie Up is only listed once, so therefore there's no real reason to vote for more than one show. So one vote, one show at checkraise.com. checkraise.com.
Yeah, you know, it feels good, too, to finally be nominated again. I mean, all the other awards were by magazines or whatever, so they wouldn't nominate us because now we have a magazine. You know, they're afraid of us getting some free publicity via their pages, which is understandable, but CheckRaise at least has no vested interest in any of these podcasts, so I'll be eager to see if we still have the fan base that's dedicated that likes to vote for us like they used to, because we won a couple awards there in the past, so. You know, I know we're not Dan Negreanu and, you know, whatever when it comes to breaking down hands, but, you know, hey, we entertain you at least, so I mean, we're worthy of a vote.
All right, well, you know, one of the things that I hope works is that we like to include our fans on the show.
Yep.
And so this week's mailbag comes from Ryan Gibbs, and we're real excited for Ryan here, Chris. You know, because part of the reason that, you know, so many of our folks that listen to the show started at really low stakes, you know, free games, and are working their way up. And here's an example. Ryan is exactly that. He's getting ready for the tournament of his life. Not his words, mine. hoping he has more. But he's real excited about it right now. And this is what he wrote in. He says, I won my way into the $360 main event qualifier for the Heartland Poker Tour at the Golden Gates Casino in Black Hawk, Colorado. They did this through a year-long home tournament they set up. You know, these are pretty popular now, Chris, I've noticed. A bunch of them are for, like, World Series seats.
Yeah.
So you can imagine the competition here if they spent all year playing to send one of them to the $360 main event qualifier.
And if I'm reading it correctly, he set this thing up, so I'm wondering if it's fixed somehow.
No, of course not. all right, so anyhow, they played for the whole year, and now he's the dude. He's the man. He's going to play for this this qualifier to get into the main event. And now he said these main event qualifying tournaments have a decent structure, and the top 20% from each earn entry into the 1650 buy-in main event. All right, so you just have to make it to the top 20%. After that, everybody's the same. It doesn't matter if you have a million chips or one chip. If you're in the top 20%, you got the $1,650 seat.
Right.
Now, he says he's never played in a big tournament like this before, so he's obviously a little nervous. But he's been looking forward to it for over a year. Visualizing. That's the first good step. Doesn't Dr. Bloomfield say that? Visualizing.
Yeah, I think he might.
And he wants to know if we have any helpful advice for playing a qualifying tournament where winning is not the objective, but making it to the top 20% is. And then he goes on to say he wants to know any advice on getting past the nerves, and then not to look ahead. Hey, you need to look ahead. Visualize. But possibly some advice when he happens to make it to the main event. So let's start with the top 20%. What are Chris Cassenza's great advice?
Well, first of all, you can't play any differently until it gets close to the bubble. I think that you need to play your game, play what you're comfortable with. There is no, you can't say, okay, I just got to make a top 20%, so let me look at my table and try to be in the top 20% in my table, and then therefore, by theory, I would be in the top 20. No, you just play your game. And when it gets close enough to the bubble, you know, that's when you start to think, okay, how big is my stack? Do I need to make a move? Do I need to do something? Because if I don't need to do something, why would I get involved? So at that point, when it gets close to the bubble or around the bubble, yes, you can fold pocket aces because there's no reason to play them and get involved with someone else who may be crazy with pocket kings and flop a king on you, and then you're in trouble and you've lost this seat where you could have won it with just one chip. So basically, I would just play my normal game, and then as it gets closer and even on the bubble, then you start to decide, okay, I don't really need to get involved here because of the size of my stack, and then just fold your way in. That's how I would do it.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. So, you know, just keep track of how far you're getting down there, and then and I don't really know at what point do you start making those different decisions, you know, whether it's 30% left, 40% left, something like that, but just be mindful of it and your chip stack. I mean, if you go on a heater in this thing and have a lot of chips, you know, that's a different story than if you're playing the short stack ninja game here.
Yeah.
But definitely, you're right. You know, don't be making these borderline calls. Be careful of who can knock you out. And your example, I mean, if people were a little surprised to hear you say you fold pocket aces, here's the case. You know, if you have pocket aces and the guy raises you and he has more chips than you, and you're down to five people to the money, what are you trying to accomplish here?
Yep.
Those chips aren't going to help you very much, and that guy can bust you. And the last thing you want to do in a tournament like this is be bust. I mean, it's completely different than in a, you know, term of the traditional payout structure. At that point, there's a lot of value to you to chip up, even against the chip leader, because those chips are going to translate to more money, hopefully.
Yep.
But here, you just want to be in the top 20%. So, you know, skip all those borderline ones and skip even some of those 60-40 deals, I think. You know, just it's wrong to say limp into it because you don't want to be passive, but, you know, there's no reason to be Johnny Bravo, I guess.
Yeah, and I'm not saying fold aces when there's 50% of the field left. I'm just saying,
right. Yeah.
Especially on the actual bubble, when they're waiting for that one guy to bust, you know, someone's going to call the short stacks all in and get them out, and then you're going to be okay. Why get involved with aces when there's a guy at your stack that's, you know, at your table bigger than you who may say, you know what, he may not have read the Chris Cassenza rule book for bubble play, and, you know, he may shove on you with kings, and you have to call with aces, you think, and then he pops a king, and you're screwed. So, really, it's mostly for the bubble play to fold the aces, but, you know, be mindful of the percentage of how many people were left in the tournament, and then gauge your action accordingly. Now, the other thing about nerves, really, I don't have any advice for nerves, because at times when I've been nervous, it's mostly just adrenaline, and once you're playing, physically actually playing the game, all that stuff goes away, and then you just, you know, you just play. I mean, if you're overly nervous, you know, and you think you're not going to be able to perform at all at these tables, you think it's going to be a problem, you know, then don't play. And I don't think that's going to be the case. So once you sit down and the cards are dealt and you get right into the rhythm, you forget that you're playing for a $1,600 seat or whatever, and just normal play takes over. At least it does for me. You, Scott, you same way?
Well, yeah. No, I'll say this about nerves. You know, if you're nervous playing in a big event, this is the kind of event you want to be in.
Yeah.
You know, when we're the top 20%, get a seat to the next one.
Yeah.
I mean, that takes a lot of pressure off, I think. You know, whereas if you let's say you already won a seat for the 1650 buy-in main event, all right, that's a different story now. Now it's a little tougher to quell those nerves. But when I know I'm just trying to play for the top 20% and get the same as everybody else in the top 20%, it's a lot easier to be a little more calm, I think.
Yeah, no, I agree, absolutely. And I guess he asked for some advice, you know, if he happens to make it to the main event. I think that, you know, it's the same thing. I mean, you obviously have played fairly well to beat your friends to get this seat, and then you played well enough to get in the top 20%, you know, of a $360 event. So really, just play your game. I would never want to give you advice that's going to make you do something that would keep you from playing your game. So really, just do what you've been doing, and I think that if you qualify for a main event seat, you're good enough to play in that main event, and there's nothing that we need to do to advise you. You just need to play your game and stay loose.
Yeah, well, I'll say this too. We talked to a couple of the people that have done really well in the Heartland Poker Tour about a year and a half ago when we were up in Chicago.
Yeah,
doing some of the Windy City Championship stuff, and they were real successful in the Heartland Poker Tour because they figured out the structure and how to play the structure. I've heard since then the structure's changed a little bit, but perhaps like any tournament, look at the structure and see if there are strategies playing that particular structure that are different than what you normally would play at Golden Gates Casino, maybe.
Yeah.
And then the other thing too is it's always hard to say how many players travel for the Heartland Poker Tour, particularly all the way out to Colorado. It's a good idea to have some table talk, I think, when you're sitting there, and find out who's played in these before and who hasn't. And if there's ones that have played in it before, they have a little bit of advantage, I think, because they know that structure and they know it. So, take some cues from them, I would think.
Well, one thing I want to say about that, too, is just don't tell them that it's your first time ever playing in one.
Oh, yeah, lie like a thief.
Yeah, don't reveal anything about your own situation that would make you look like a novice or an amateur unless you felt like that was going to be your advantage. And in this case, I know it's not going to be because you really are playing in your first one and you're looking for advice. So if you're going to have table talk, don't make it sound like, it's your first time in the big city and, you want to see all the tourist sites. You know what I mean? Just, if you're going to have banter talk with them, make it so that it's, you know what you're doing and you want to hear what they have to say.
Yeah, it's the ultimate free angle shoot.
Yeah.
It's table talk before the tournament starts. I mean, there's no rules for it.
That's
so
right.
If you want to be a doctor, you could be a doctor. All right, Ryan, we appreciate you sending in that email, as we always do when you do. For other folks, please remember, email us at podcast@anyupmagazine.com, and you will win some wonderful swag, like a T-shirt from PMS Pokerware, which sells hilarious shirts for gals and guys in the Antiup store at antiupstore.com.
Our hotline is 813-448-1120. You call it, we use it, we give. That's the way. That's the slogan from now on. So this one comes from Craig Patrick, and he's got a new game he loves.
Earlier podcast, you talked about the 10-game mix that's done at Imperial Palace. So I looked up those games at your comment and found the one called Crazy Pineapple Ocean. At our home game, we introduced it last week, and it was such a hit that we kept playing it over and over again, and we decided to shorten the name to SpongeBob because we could get that out easier. And we had a blast playing it. If you haven't played it in your home game, I suggest that you introduce it. Called Crazy Pineapple Ocean. It has six streets to it.
That is the greatest name for a it makes so much sense. They call it SpongeBob. That is hilarious.
Yeah, I love it. It's great.
Oh, man. A pineapple under the sea. SpongeBob SquarePants. Oh, my God. Do you watch that show?
I've never watched SpongeBob. And I used to tell people, I'm not into kids shows. And every person I told that to, hey, it's not a kids show.
I watched the SpongeBob movie once. That was pretty funny. David Hasselhoff. It was pretty funny. But, the kids in the family sometimes will watch it. Although the youngest kids are forbidden from watching it. Apparently it's too violent or something.
Yeah,
I don't know.
Yeah,
but,
yeah.
Yeah, it's pretty funny. And that's hilarious. That's a great name for it. And I think we should call that in the home game now. Let's play SpongeBob.
Right after we play War Raz. all right, so Craig, we appreciate you calling. And everybody else, remember the line to call us is 813-448-1120. And we will give you something great, like we're giving Craig a download of the Poker Ham Breakdown Pro, a hand history analysis program for single or mixed games from element26.net. Pretty sure it does not help us with Crazy Pineapple Ocean, but maybe in version 3.6.
I think you need to read the feedback.
Yeah, yeah.
It's about me.
You're always the lightning rod. Lately.
Yes.
I've got feedback backed up for the next 6 weeks, all based off stuff you've said on the show. So
that's what I'm here for, baby.
All right, David Bloomberg. Remember, he's the editor leader of Reality News Online.
Oh, I thought he was the mayor of New York.
No, that's Michael Bloomberg.
Oh, I was close.
Yeah, you're close. great, now we got more feedback to talk about. anyhow, he wrote in, we were talking about the, obviously, the fantastic World Series live coverage. At least I call it fantastic.
It was good.
And he said, Chris was discussing how it might not be fair to some of the big pros who put on the live-ish feature table. But look at it from the other side. Daniel Negreanu had friends dedicated to watching ESPN 3 or 2 and texting him information about his opponents. I think he even said he had a guy who was a great reader of live tells giving him info. Then he went on dinner break to his trailer out back and watched the DVR play. In other words, he took great advantage of the situation in a way that other players couldn't, so I don't feel like he was really put at a disadvantage by being put on a featured table. Fight.
David. Well, you know, that was only a minute point, you know, and again, he says in his letter, you know, that other players couldn't do that. Well, I don't think that's true. Other players could have done it. Other players could have had friends watching. Other players could have had friends texting. I just feel like, you know, what they were complaining about was, one, the limited use of patches. If you're going to put us on table and put us at disadvantage, because the whole world will remember how Dan Negreanu played, but they're not going to remember how Joe Schmo played one hand against him. They're going to all focus on Dan Negreanu because you remember who he is, and you can see how he's playing and what he had, is versus him getting the limited information about a couple of players here and there, you know, at the one time that he's playing them, and those players could be eliminated or removed. But Danny Negreanu's play is going to be remembered forever because of who he is and how often they're going to put him at the feature table and keep giving up his information constantly, whereas these other players who aren't big-time pros aren't going to be at this table constantly every single time. Negreanu's at the feature table every time he played. Mm-hmm. And to me, no matter how much information he's getting from the players he's sitting around him, it can't be as beneficial as what players are seeing when they see Negreanu, because they're going to see him all the time on TV. I don't know. I just felt like the big-time pros were still at a disadvantage and couldn't reap the benefits of being at the table financially as well as, you know, strategy-wise. And I don't know. I mean, I see what he's saying, but if he could do that, then everybody else could do it too. So that's not an advantage. That's everyone has the same situation that they're in at that feature table. So it's still
a disadvantage. To clarify, I mean, your point is that these pros are exposed more often than other players, not so much that they are exposed differently or can't fight back on it.
Exactly.
You know, certainly I would never in any situation say that Dan on the ground was at a disadvantage playing me heads up.
Right.
You know, let's tie both hands behind his back, blindfold him, you know, put him in a soundproof chamber and take his cards away. And I'm still betting on him over me.
Yeah, you still lose in about five hands.
So it's relative, but I definitely get your point that, you know, if the feature table, TV table were completely random and they just picked, Brasilia Orange 363, and if it was, you know, 10 schmucks that no one's ever seen in their lives, that's what they put on TV, that's a different story. But we know that doesn't happen. They, right. You know, they roam the room and look for tables where people have players that people know.
Yep.
And that in itself is where the disadvantage comes in.
Thank you, right? Scott. You actually defended me.
I know. I'm going to have to shower as soon as I get the show, so let's move right on to housekeeping then. All right, hey, let everybody know that the Windy City Poker Championship, we did a couple guest spots. Filling in for Kirk in Chicago, Jason. And the first of those two episodes debuted last Sunday. I'm sure you can still catch it in reruns on Chicago Sportsnet in Chicago. And our second episode is coming up this Sunday, I believe, and you can catch it all week. But if you do not live anywhere where you get the Chicago Sportsnet Comcast, they are on YouTube already. Much better than those cartoony things that some guys did for us 5 years ago. Let us make fun of ourselves. We don't need other people making fun of us.
Yeah, we get enough of that. And our cruise is coming up, too. Don't forget our cruise.
Yeah, I like going on the cruise. The phone's just ringing off the hook for the cruise here. We got a lot of last-minute folks. I love poker players. Wait till the last minute.
Yep.
Calling up, hey, do you still got room on the cruise? Well, yeah. Okay, well, can I get it for the same price? Well, no. Oh, why not? Oh, because you waited the last minute. But, yeah, we do still have opportunity to get you on the summer cruise, August 29th to September 2nd. Rates start at $369. I'll do my best to get you for that price, but don't whine to me if I can't. And then our seven-nighter in December going out of New Orleans. Getting a lot of reaction to this already, so I'm really excited about this one. And, of course, we mentioned last week, we just added the Women's Championship, sponsored by the Lips Tour. That's going to be on Thursday. We're going to have a 125 buy-in. Women only, and we mean that. We're not bound by these weird laws where, you know, we can let men play. Women only. But the whole overall cruise is our normal Antioch poker cruise, Chris.
Yes.
For men, women, children of 18 or older. But this is just an added element to reward the women who sail with us. And I think it's going to be a lot of fun.
I'm looking forward to it. And, you know, what else? One last thing. We're still looking for ambassadors who'd like to have a voice in their own poker community and represent Antioch while they're there. We have a full list of the areas that we're still looking for. We have quite a few now, actually. We have a lot of people representing Antioch around the country for us. But if you go to antiochmagazine.com/ambassadors, you can see the list there and find out if you have a place to represent us.
Yeah, not very many left.
No, so we're doing pretty well.
Get in there.
You know what, Scott? I know that I miss Colombo.
Of course, we all miss Colombo.
And we missed. He's a good friend of ours, and we missed. But we missed the segment because you and I don't play as much as we used to, and that segment really helped us get some more strategy on the show. And we waited a while, and it's been a while since he's been gone. But someone finally wanted to try to step up and fill those rather enormous shoes that the great detective wore. And that someone is Malcolm O'Malley. He's a longtime listener and a frequent contributor to the show. And today we're going to debut O'Malley's Move.
I love it.
Yeah, it's a new segment. It'll remind us of what the old one-minute mystery was, but it's a little different. And we're real excited to have him aboard. So here we go. Here's the debut of O'Malley's Move.
Hello, and welcome to O'Malley's Move. I'm Malcolm O'Malley. This week, we're sitting at a $1, $2, no-limit hold'em casino cash game. We've been playing for quite a while, and currently have around $700 to our name. We're the second biggest stack at the table, as there is one stack nearing $800. Other than that, the closest stack to us has around $300. The blind's post, and it's folded to us in middle position. We look down at ace of clubs, queen of diamonds. With only three to act behind us, not including the blinds, we make the standard table raise to $15. It's folded to the button, who calls the $15. Our read on him is he is an action junkie who likes to get in and mix it up. He can't stop talking about how he hates playing 1-2 and can't wait for a spot on the 2-5 table to open up. He's only been there for about an hour, but has caused a strain on the otherwise friendly atmosphere. Straddling one under the gun, raising most every pot, and his favorite move seems to be getting to the flop with a small pair and trying to flop a set. He's busted one player doing that already. What's worse is he's the player with 800 behind. Small blind folds, big blind calls, with about 185 behind. The pot stands at $46, and we see a flop of queen of hearts, five of hearts, three of clubs. Well, we couldn't have asked for much more. When you play ace-queen for a raise pre-flop and get called, you're really hoping to hit your queen. And that's exactly what happened. The big blind checks, not surprisingly, and it comes to us. Since we're the pre-flop aggressor and we hit our hand, we have to put in a bet here. The problem is the amount. Our opponent, who has us out-chipped, loves chasing draws and smooth-calling monsters. So we're not sure we can define his hand now. Any standard bet, 1/2 to 3/4 pot, would have him calling with any piece of it, and an overbet would just make us look desperate. But maybe that's what we want. At any rate, figuring the button will call, we settle on pot. Expecting this will only push the big blind out, we make it $45 to go. The button calls, the big blind folds, the pot is 136, and the turn brings the 9 of clubs. So, we're first to act with 640 behind. Are we slowing down here?
All right, folks, and as always, go to the forum at antiochmagazine.com/forum. Chime in with what you would do. And next week, after Chris and I are much smarter after listening to all of you, we'll act like smarter. and tell you what we would have done, even though it's probably completely different than what we would say right now if we were going to put ourselves out there. And, of course, we'll have the conclusion next week. Looking forward to it.
Well, you know what? I'm sure that some news stories piled up on your desk this week. I know you've been busy doing crew stuff and everything, but I'm sure you found some stuff. So what's going on out there?
All right, Epic Poker, the new name of the professional poker series headed up by Jeffrey Pollack and Annie Duke, has signed a deal for 20 hours of its inaugural tournament to air on CBS and the new HD cable channel Velocity. Veteran sportscaster Pat O'Brien and Ali Niyad will do the commentary in shows produced by 441 Productions, who previously produced the World Series of Poker's television programming.
Pat O'Brien, holy cow.
Well, this is Pat O'Brien.
No alcohol in the booth.
Well, you know, this is... I talked about this a lot on Short Stack Radio last night. Big move, I think, here with this Epic Poker. I mean, we thought when they bought Heartland Poker Tour, the reason they would do that is that they have a ready-made television production company and airtime. And then as soon, like a month after they do that, all of a sudden now they reach this deal for to be on CBS.
Yeah, I'm not even sure I understand what's going on. If 441 Productions is doing it, right? So
yeah,
and they did the World Series stuff. So
yep.
I what is Heartland doing?
I don't know, and I guess we'll be watching for the next month or so here before the events start to see what really comes of that. But yeah, very interesting. Also interesting that it's on CBS, on the actual CBS, not some CBS Sports Channel,
right?
And then this Velocity channel is being rebranded as kind of a high-end men's network.
I never heard of Velocity, to be honest with you. I have a lot of HD channels. Have you?
Well, it's brand new. It hasn't even launched yet. It's going to launch in, I believe, in October.
Okay, but it's not like Spike when it got relaunched.
Well, yeah,
whatever,
it's like,
you know,
some kind of like Discovery Channel right
okay.
now. They're
going to
change the name and rebrand it, very quickly, apparently.
Man.
Velocity.
Oh, well, that should be interesting. all right, Bodog will leave the U.S. market on December 31st when its contract with Moores Mohawk Gaming expires. Bodog has secured a gaming license from the U.K. Gaming Commission, and Moores Mohawk is expected to launch its own online product in 2012.
Probably no big real surprise here.
No.
You know, it's getting tougher to operate in the U.S. market, and... you know, I think Bodog really wanted to get on it. They've got a big brand, worldwide brand as it is. And, Moores Mohawk gets its all gaming commission stuff from the same folks that oversaw UB.
Yeah.
So, you know, you got a little tinge there that's still in some people's minds. So,
the first thing that came into my mind was, I wonder if Evelyn Ng will stay with Bodog and move back to Toronto where she's from, maybe? Or is she just not that deal going to be over with? I wonder what's going to happen there.
Interesting. You know, Calvin Ayer did a real good job of building Bodog beyond the online poker
into
a whole lifestyle brand. So, you know, talk about some geniuses in online poker. This was a guy that made his money on online poker and then was smart enough, well before all this trouble, to realize that he could make money elsewhere.
Yeah.
So. All right, finally, Phil Gordon has been the first defendant in the lawsuit against Full Tilt and Tiltware to be dismissed from the case. Gordon's lawyer said Gordon never held an operational role or made any management decisions for Full Tilt.
Hmm. I think it's funny. I'm not sure, but I think I read somewhere, too, that a lot of the pros are trying to get out of it, right? I mean, they're not just...
Oh, certainly. No one wants to be on this lawsuit. They want to get out as quickly as they can. And this was kind of the case, too. I think when we first saw it, we kind of laughed. You know, it's classic lawyering.
Yeah.
You know, the more names you attach to it, the more likely you are to get something out of the suit. And then, you know, you put the burden on the people that you name to, you know, go to court and get themselves extracted from it. So, you know, it sucks if you're that person, and it's effective if you're on the other side of it. And I think we knew going in that most – it wasn't like there was a big – despite what the commercials make you seem like, there wasn't this big triumvirate around a big oval table there of all these Full Tilt pros making the decisions.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of them were just marketing contracts to make it look better. So, you know, if you weren't involved in any of the decisions, you just got paid by them, you know, it doesn't seem like you should be part of a lawsuit.
Absolutely.
This is Daniel Negreanu of FullContactPoker.com. You're listening to Ante Up.
You know, every once in a while, Chris, something we write strikes a nerve with lots of people, and that's exactly what happened when I told readers of Annie Up Magazine that many poker rooms in Florida were feeling forced to increase their jackpot rake to $2 to keep up with the Joneses.
Yep.
Ironically, though, all the feedback we received has been from players outside of Florida, which I guess just proves that people in Florida just don't care about this. And those who contacted Annie Up were generally of the feeling that the jackpot rake inflation that we're seeing is largely poker rooms being greedy on the backs of their loyal players. And as usual, I did my best to let them know both sides of the coin. But I was really happy when I told today's guest about the discussion, and he offered to not only write a column for the magazine on it, but also come on the show and give us a look at the issue from the side of the operator as well as the player. Elliot Schechter is director of poker operations at Downstream Casino Resort in Quapaw, Oklahoma. He's also worked in rooms in Florida and Nevada and probably elsewhere, and is regarded by many poker room managers as among the brightest in the biz. Elliot, thanks for joining us today.
Well, that's a hell of a lead-in. Glad to be here.
Richly deserved, though. It was amazing to me before I got the chance to meet you that how many people spoke highly of you, and we've enjoyed having your voice in the magazine on a couple issues, and particularly this one, because I think this is one that players really kind of get a little upset about, and probably wouldn't get as upset about if they kind of knew the backstory, which I'm sure you'll be happy to give us.
Absolutely.
I was personally impressed with his ability to make players fold their low and stud eight in the rotation of horse at the Venetian when he had a monster pot out there. I was highly impressed with that.
Well, that was maybe the shrewdest play of my poker career.
All right, let's get into this here. The main criticism players have of the jackpot rake is that they view it as the poker room using the players' money to promote the room. How do you see that, Elliot?
Well, the right and the wrong. If it's on the table in front of a player, of course it belongs to him. As soon as it makes it into the box, it belongs to the casino. And it's pretty hard to dispute that. Possession is 9/10 of the law. They're free to vote with their feet, but I'm pretty sure they'd soon be marching themselves into empty rooms with no action.
You know, not all poker rooms take a rake, though, for the jackpot. We had our esteemed ambassador from Las Vegas on, Michael Homai, and he told our listeners that, you know, destination resorts like Ari and Bellagio don't take it. What makes those rooms different from the others as far as the need to take the rake?
Well, the fact that they are destinations in and of themselves. Most of those rooms, the Venetian, the Bellagio, the Aria, the Wynn, those are five-diamond, five-star resorts amongst the nicest resort hotel casinos in the entire world. Poker is probably not in their top 10 revenue producers and revenue generators. People go to those places just to visit and to be amongst the people who like to see and be seen. They don't need to promote and market, and in fact, if you go to their websites, you couldn't even find notice of any kind of promotion, regardless of gaming department. Hmm. Those places just don't do it and don't have to. Right. Those of us back on the ground level, as opposed to up in the stratosphere, absolutely need to promote. We are not destination resorts so much as places to play, almost convenience rooms, although that's certainly not my case, and probably not the case in Florida, where there's certainly limited competition. But it is a cutthroat competition. And the bigger number you can throw at somebody, the more of a chance you have to get that person's body in your seats. There's a lot of keeping up with the Joneses, as you had mentioned, and that's a big problem. I mean, free enterprise is set up for two companies or more to compete with each other for the same customer. Well, a customer will smartly go where they're going to find ways to give them better value, or at least better perceived value.
Right.
The raise from 1 to 2 is probably a long time coming in this country. The dollar, if you look at it in macro terms, the dollar is certainly worth less than it's been in quite a long time, and it certainly doesn't stretch as far. Inflationary forces have been at work, especially if you consider food and energy prices, which, of course, are very conveniently taken out of the inflation calculations by our government. But in the real world, we have to buy gasoline and we have to put food on the table, so that matters. And the dollar doesn't go as far, and $2 obviously goes a lot farther. In purely micro terms, of course, it's noticeable. It's a 100% increase in the amount of jackpot money taken. On the other hand, most of that money is finding its way through smaller amounts. Very few places are just putting all jackpot money towards an ever-growing, unhittable, bad beat jackpot. Most places are finding ways to give that money back to the players on a very, very regular basis, daily and hourly. So again, it's not like you're not getting the money. And lo and behold, as long as it's not in bad beats, your shot of getting that money is much greater, especially the very popular high hand awards down in Florida. Shoot, if you're a somewhat patient player, you're going to be playing hands that obviously have a better chance of making high hands. So... the complaints from the players are tough, but shoot, once it's in the jackpot box, it's not theirs, and at least it's going back to the players in some form. And additionally, I lost my train of thought on that one.
All right, we'll get you back on track here. I argued in my column that players need to look past that dollar or two being dragged from the pot and focus on the types of players who are attracted by bad jackpots and the like, and how profitable they can be to a solid player. How far off base was I?
Not far at all. The typical player in a typical poker room is a low-limit recreational player, somebody who is playing at a comfortable level where they're almost completely not in danger of going broke. On the other hand, they, as a group, seem to love getting these $100, $200, $500, $1,000 hourly or daily prizes. It's bankroll refillers. And there's a lot to be said about that. You put a buy-in in front of somebody, they're going to stay in play. I mean, if you buy somebody a house or a car, well, obviously, that's not going on the table. You give them $50,000 or $100,000, that money's leaving the room. At least this money, and that was where my train of thought was heading, at least this money is staying in action, which makes the games better, and it puts more money in front of bad players, and obviously they're the ones from whom you're taking the money. So there's not much downside to this. There isn't. If you're fishing in a pond, and for some reason, the people who are doing the fishing are literally throwing their fish back off their hooks so you can catch them. Well, shoot, that's where you're supposed to fish all the time. This is absolutely that situation. Players will congregate around these promotions, making the games better. They're obviously not paying attention to the economic effect of what money gets taken off the table via jackpot, via rake, via tokes. If they're not paying attention, they obviously can't be classified as a top-notch player. If they're not a top-notch player, there's somebody you can win money from. So if you're choosing not to play with those players because they're taking too high a jackpot rake, even though it can be borne out that there isn't a positive expected value that would make it worthwhile to play, then you are making a drastic error.
Well, you know, there are some negatives. You mentioned that there are some negatives, and I guess one of them would be when, you know, Joe and Steve, tourists, come to town to visit Aunt Glynis, show up at your poker room, hit the bad beat for $300,000 and leave and go to their back to their state. But really, are there other negatives that you've encountered?
That is the big one.
Yeah.
And every time I paid out a bad beat in my career, I hear the screams, and I just pray, God, let them be people who live around here. And then once in a while, you look around the corner, and you start to cringe. It's like, oh, no, this can't be good.
Yeah.
But at least the hourly, the daily prizes, whether it's high hands or hot seats or drawings, those generally almost all go towards local players, who obviously make up the bulk of any card room's player population. But even if they don't, at least that money stays in play.
Yeah.
And that's huge. I mean, shoot, if the money stays in play, I mean, it's not only good for the good player in the very, very short run, meaning that a bad player has a buy-in in front of them, but it goes to follow that that game will have more hours in its life, giving the good player even more opportunity to win more money. At least those daily promotions, which seem to be what is being paid for out of the new $2 jackpot rake, is quite productive that way. A lot of that money comes right back. And in play in a positive way, it makes games better. People will chase and play those games longer. A bad player obviously will lose his funds more quickly than a good player. If all of a sudden he smacks down a high hand and then has a buy-in place in front of him, well, shoot. He will incorrectly think he's playing on someone else's money and probably sit there and enjoy the game a lot more and giving away those chips too. Well, it wasn't his, which again, as we pointed out before, possession's 9/10 of the law. If it's in front of you, it's yours.
Yeah.
Well, can you tell us a little bit about the strategy that goes in deciding how much jackpot rake to drop? I mean, for example, you'd mentioned, I think, in your column that the jackpot rake in some jurisdictions lets rooms get around maximum rake rules, and also that in most places the jackpot rake isn't taxed, whereas a normal rake is.
Exactly. In most places, in Nevada, California, you must return 100% of the jackpot funds. You can't, in some places they let you keep a custodial fee. Almost all places uniformly don't let you do that. So basically it's a deal that the Gaming Control Board or the regulatory body makes with the poker rooms at the individual casinos. If you want to generate a marketing fund, we will let you take more than the maximum allowable rake of 10%, but you must have verifiable and auditable records, and you must return this money to the players in some form. It seems to work out. I mean, when you go to buy a car and there's a rebate on there, that rebate's not a gift. That rebate was funded by the last 20 people who bought a car.
Yeah.
It's the same thing. Costs get passed on to customers. And at least in this fashion, we're actually telling you how much we're taking and we're telling you how much we're giving back. And we try to make rules for these promotions rather easy to understand. But in most jurisdictions, you can keep taking rake as long as you want, as long as you're not going over a certain percentage. And as I pointed out in the article, I mean, I would imagine most rooms would adjust the way I described, where, okay, if we're not allowed to do jackpot promotions, we'll just keep taking more rake and give that money back to the players. And I would imagine that most finance and accounting departments of these casinos wouldn't let a real good amount go back to the players.
Well, obviously, rooms can take the rake differently, too. Some take it in intervals, some take it all at once. At what point do you think players should be vocal about when that jackpot rake is taken?
I think they should be vocal in two very, very peculiar spots. There are some rooms that take it before a card is even put on the table, which, in my opinion, is quite usurious and obscene. I mean, if you don't have a hand in front of you, how can you win a high hand or a bad beat jackpot?
Right.
Or have your aces cracked? You can't. You obviously have no hand and you have no flop to make a hand. I mean, that's virtually criminal. So rooms that do that, I would absolutely recommend to players, speak up. If you can, play somewhere where they don't take advantage of you. I personally believe it should be taken a little bit later in the hand. It's fairly traditional in Nevada to take it at the $20 level. So this way, when there's a $10 pot, you're not taking two out of it, which would effectively make the marginal tax rate on $10 pots 20%, which is really tough. At least if you take it on 20, you're taking 3 out of 20, which, of course, drops that marginal tax rate down to 15%. Which would seem to be a lot more fair. in the room I operate here, we take it at 30, only because it's a reflex mechanism. Our rake is 3 on 30. So if we're getting the 3 for the rake, we know we get a dollar for the jackpot. It makes it much easier for both the dealers and the players.
Does that mean that to win the hand, the pot, jackpot, whatever it is, you have to have at least 30 in the pot at your place?
Yeah, for the bad beats and royal flushes, yes.
Yes, okay.
But when it comes for the daily type promotions, no. As long as you're playing in a jackpot eligible game, you will win the drawing.
Okay.
And generally, that's how it works down in Florida, where the high hand jackpot is certainly very prevalent. They're not keeping track of whether the jackpot got dropped in the hand you won the high hand with or not, I don't think, although they should.
Right.
I mean, high hand jackpots are certainly a pretty big thing down in Florida, and that's very labor intensive, especially in the bigger rooms, which they're most of them just aren't small rooms.
Right.
So now you've got to have extra supervisors and brush personnel around to keep track of all these tables and players and dealers screaming out the latest highest hand to be made. And keeping track and making sure that everybody else knows about it. It's not a labor-free endeavor whatsoever.
Well, you know, another common complaint we hear from players is they accuse Runes of stealing from the jackpot rake because they don't appear to be paying out as much as they appear to be taking in every day. And we've done our best to explain to them where the money's going and that it is actually getting back to them. But can you help dispel this myth a little more for us?
I will certainly help dispel that. And let's use Florida, where, I mean, that would certainly be the best examples. The Florida card rooms are pretty well regulated. They can only take a certain percentage of rake, and it is 10%. Their jackpots are actually really well regulated and were legalized way after the games themselves were made legal in public settings. The state absolutely comes in and expects published numbers from the card rooms in Florida, and likewise does audit the books for the jackpots. There is very little set. There's nothing to be gained other than, obviously, untaxed revenue, which the casinos would be opening themselves up to amazing criminal charges and fraud, because jackpot money, by agreement in most jurisdictions across the country, is untaxed because it is going back to the players as part of their winnings. It gets taxed on the back end via income tax if the awards are large enough. The rooms have to be very careful. I mean, you get hit with enough fraud charges, you're obviously going to lose your right to hold gaming activity in your facility. Casinos just aren't going to jeopardize that over, let's face it, in the scheme of things, especially if you've got slot machines, amounts that are truly too small to be... to be incentive enough to want to steal it.
And there are ratios too, right?
That you're playing. Pardon?
And there are ratios too where the state would come in and see, okay, table X dropped X amount of money for a rake, for the normal rake. They would know that the jackpot rake has to be in the ballpark of that as well, otherwise they would know something was up. It's not like they can just take the box in the back room, divide it up among themselves, and then say, okay, don't say anything. There's definitely some sort of balances here, right? Checks and balances that would make them be able to be regulated, right?
Absolutely. I mean, if your max rake is $5, as it is in Florida, or 4, as it is in Las Vegas, you're generally going to have about a 3.75 to 4.0 ratio the jackpot dollars,
right?
And in Nevada, it'll probably be down around 2.75 to 3. And once that skews in one direction or the other, whether it's obviously too much jackpot per rake dollar or too little jackpot per rake dollar, absolutely. Whether it's your internal auditors or whether it's gaming control board auditors or paramutual in Florida, this pops out.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a pretty standard. You should be generating somewhere between 25 to 35 jackpot dollars per hour at $1 pull. And obviously that almost doubles at $2 pull, depending on when you're getting the second dollar. If you're taking two as soon as you can, well, then obviously it's a straight double. If you're getting two later down the hand, whether it's one on 10 or one on 20 or one on 20 and one on 40, obviously you're not going to have a strict 100% double. But there's accountants and people who are accountants working for auditors and control boards that know this. This is not rocket science. And these watchdogs are, especially in Florida where there's limited casino gaming and licensing, they've got time on their hands to actually pay attention to this. The players are fairly well protected. And if you're talking about Indian gaming, every Indian gaming operation has a gaming commission to report to that is omnipresent. I mean, they have 100% access to our books, 100% access to our surveillance rooms. They can enter any room in the facility to make sure that we're doing things all right, and are quicker to flag than the standard control board or gaming commission. So this money is just not worth the risk. I mean, it's great that you can find a way to take more than 10% of the pot, but the penalty is too great. I mean, you're not just stealing from the players. Once you decide to book that as income, unless you absolutely display it on your books as generated revenue and pay taxes on it, you're now skimming, which is, of course, going to lead to RICO charges. There's just too many things that are negative and not enough positive to not paying this money back to the players. There's very little incentive for us to actually decide to bank this money. It makes no sense.
Part of
why
major...
would we want to cut off our marketing funds? This is money we're obviously using to market and promote our rooms.
Again,
if competition is tough, why would we cut our marketing budget? That makes no sense whatsoever, too.
Right.
Well, part of what made your column so interesting, Elliot, is that you're a player too, as Chris mentioned, and you obviously have to pay the jackpot rake like everyone else when you play. One of the reasons you mentioned as a positive is looking at it similar to premiums we pay for insurance on our house and cars.
Exactly. You made a statement that the bad beat is a myth, and I guess from purely statistical terms that is correct, but in life terms, I can't agree with it. There are bad beats. I mean, shoot, if a drunk driver plows off the road and takes your mailbox down and then slams into your parked car, well, shoot, that's a bad beat.
Yeah.
It was a complete freak happening. And, well, if you have homeowner's insurance and auto insurance, it'll at least help you get those those things repaired. It is the exact same thing. I learned from a bunch of good players years and years ago, and one of the universal points was if a game is good enough to beat, then you should play it. Don't worry about the rake. If you're good enough, you're going to overcome the rake. You're making them pay the rake. And that's a pretty advanced concept for poker players, but it certainly applies here. If the game is good, you're supposed to play. And it never bothered me what money was coming off the table. I was able to pay attention closely enough, and when the texture of a game changes, when there's not enough dead money, when there's not enough unskillful play, the money coming off the table is going to matter. But the whole point of throwing money at promotions is to tilt it way, way, way far from the equilibrium point and get the games to be playable. Action produces action. As Yogi Berra said, nobody goes there anymore. It's too crowded. But that's exactly what we're trying to do here. It's crowded because the games are good. And the games are good because, well, obviously, the less than skillful players aren't happening to them. It never bothered me to play in games with high rake. And by high, I mean $5 to $6 to $7. If the game can take it, shoot, I've sat down in games that were taking $10 rake. And again, the game was good enough to beat it. So, again, didn't matter.
Well, as and a player... Oh, go ahead, Scott.
No, I guess I was going to say, as part of that, too, you mentioned that, you know, you know, if you lose the quads, you're not losing. I mean, if you're losing with quads, you're not losing because you're not a skillful player. You just got unlucky, and that if you generate some kind of bonus from that, from the poker room, then that is in essence the insurance payout that you're getting, and that dollar from or $2 from every pot is your premium.
Absolutely, it's the truth. I mean, and granted, to make a hand like quads or a straight flush, it generally isn't skillful. The skill is in extracting the maximum payment from your opponent or opponents. Well, losing with that hand is certainly not skillful or unskillful. It's quite accidental. But shoot, especially with no limit being the game in most places, losing with that hand is going to crush you. And it's quite common now for bigger games to have jackpots removed from them, therefore making them jackpot eligible. Well, shoot. Obviously, the higher up in level you go as far as no limit or even limit, the more likely it is that the people playing the game have more of their wealth or income on the table while they're playing. Well, now insurance is almost mandatory. Before the caps were placed on buy-ins, it was very common for pot limit and no limit players to ask for insurance, which has now led to the running it twice. But to get back to insurance, it was very common. Okay, I'll pay you $300 if I win the pot, and if I lose the pot, well, you pay me this. Right. It was very common. That's how Amarillo Slim made his living in the 80s and early 90s. Was basically hovering around poker rooms in the big games and saying, okay, you want insurance on that hand? That's how David Skolansky really came to prominence. He way before there were laptop computers and stuff, he had made charts and always kept them with him. And if Slim wasn't around, they would go up to David Skolansky and say, okay, what's the insurance rate on this hand? Okay, we got this many outs and that much in the pot. Yes, your insurance rate should be $240. Oh, okay, thank you. And people would buy insurance on their big hands. They knew. So to bring that insurance down to the recreational level or the lower levels is huge. Again, the hands are the same. They're going to play the same way, especially now that even the smaller games are some kind of no limit. To have that kind of insurance is gigantic. And especially, it's not like you're just making up for the pot. Now you're literally almost winning a lottery ticket. And if you're a good enough player beating the game consistently, you're not paying those premiums. You're forcing your opponents to pay the premiums. I mean, if you call the letter U the universe of poker money, U equals losses plus rake plus jackpot plus tips. Right. Notice I didn't say winnings. It also equals winnings minus all of that. The universe is not just the winnings. The universe is the entire money. So winnings is calculated and derived after the expenses are deducted. Well, so if you won, you're not paying any of those fees. You're making your opponents pay. So this is free insurance. Why would you ever pass that up? It's too huge. You make a straight flush and lose. I mean, God. I'd much rather have a jackpot in play just to not see grown men cry and complain.
Well, as a player and an operator, what do you feel are the best promotions, you know, such as like bad beat versus high hand?
It's tough. As an operator, I certainly don't like promotions that become ridiculously labor-intensive. Just because I think it takes away from the fun atmosphere of the room. Now, instead of providing a very high level of service, you have to at least make sure everybody in the room is lending their time towards getting this promotion off, instead of actually seating players and greeting players and making sure everybody's got cocktails and meals and is on the right lists. So it can become a detriment at that point. I certainly appreciate promotions that make crowds congregate. I'm not a big fan of timed promotions. Okay, we're going to give this money away at this particular time, and then 30 minutes later we're giving away this money at this particular time. Although the high hand jackpot does try to prevent that, at least you must be actively playing to make a high hand. So therefore, even if they're giving the money away, if you haven't played a hand, you can't win it.
Right.
So there's a lot of upside. The problem is the downside is the labor and service level, which I'm not a big fan of. I mean, Texas Hold'em is Texas Hold'em, and every room basically provides the same game. The only thing we can do different is provide a different experience. So if we're not providing 100% service at a level that you should get, especially in higher rate rooms, and then it's certainly not fair to the players. Now from an operator standpoint, I certainly don't like promotions that can certainly go negative, certainly run a deficit. It is not good for anybody.
Right.
It's good for the player. Obviously, they're obviously getting more than what they put into it, and it's great. It's definitely a positive return on their investment. But at some point, it causes the people doing the books to basically shut it down rather unceremoniously. Not a big fan of bad beats, even though as an operator, the number on the board usually attracts players. Not a big fan of it at all, only because you either set them too hard to hit, drawing the big number, but now you're locking up all these people's money for way too long. Or if you set them too easy to hit, I mean, the fun never grows, and the number never gets big, and you're not attracting players, and now you're doing a lot of paperwork all the time to give away rather small amounts of money.
Right.
So, I mean, I've really never found gigantic upside with a bad beat as an operator. As a player, I love bad beats, especially in visiting rooms that have big bad beats, because I have the same shot at hitting as anybody else does, and God knows if I'm the new player to that room, I contributed $0 to that bad beat, so my return is gigantic.
Excellent. Well, Elliot, we appreciate you joining us. We know you're a busy man, so we'll let you get back to running downstream, but we'll give you opportunity to tell us some exciting stuff that's coming up at downstream in the months.
We have the Heartland Poker Tour making its next appearance here in October from the 13th to the 23rd. 100,000 guaranteed first place in that event, $1,100 buy-in. That is our next big event. The bad beat right now is 143,000 and counting. Only $1 taken out, by the way, for all you Florida listeners.
And neither Chris nor I have contributed to that, so it would be a massive improvement for us.
Very high EV, I would imagine.
All right, well, thank you again, Elliot. Best of luck with the Heartland Poker Tour, and I hope you continue to impart your wisdom for our readers and on the show, and we appreciate you again joining us today.
You're welcome. Anytime you want to have me back, just let me know. I'd be glad to do it. I had a lot of fun.
Thanks, Elliot.
Hi, this is Shannon Elizabeth, and you are listening to the Antietta PokerCast.
I always like hands of the week to start out like this, Chris. Love the podcast.
All right, vote for us.
I'm immensely more likely to make that a hand of the week than the you guys suck. But here's a hand of the week to prove how sucky you really are. And we get our share of those as well, too.
Yeah, we just don't put them on the show.
Well, sometimes we do. Depends on this.
We just edit it carefully.
All right, this comes from TJ Walters, all the way from San Diego, California.
Beautiful weather there.
Yeah, we'll be distributing the magazine there in one short month.
Yeah, September.
Looking forward to it. And despite all the great poker he has out there, Chris, this came from a home game.
Yeah.
It's fine. You know, we got good poker here.
Yeah, of course. That's fine.
But I always think that's funny, too. Yeah, anyway, hey, this comes from a home game. All right. He said this was he played this home game for the first time a few weeks ago. And just so you know, too, he found it using Meetup.
Oh, yeah.
All right. So these are not necessarily people that he knows. So he's in addition to normal home game where you kind of have his.
Okay.
Kind of know them outside of the poker world and just have to figure out how they play poker.
Yeah.
Now you're beating these people for the first time. All right. He immediately noticed that there was a lot of loose play, weak aces and king jacks opening, and second pairs on the flop betting like they had top set. What's wrong with all this stuff? I do this all the time.
He didn't say there's anything wrong with it. He just noticed it.
He just noticed it. That's right. So this is a strategy. Then it was to play super tight. So I decided to still play tight, but be more willing to open pots with average hands or in good position. So before we get in the hand, what do you think about that? How do you approach a game that's this wild, wild west?
Well, I think we always basic ABC poker is that if you do the opposite of what people are doing. So if they're real loose, you should tighten up, and if they're real tight, you should loosen up. So it sounds like a sound strategy. He said he's going to be tight, right, for a while until
Well, yeah, but then
out.
He said he was willing to open pots with average hands.
Well, maybe he's a loose player. I don't know.
Maybe
he's a loose player. I mean, it depends on how comfortable he is. I mean, if he thinks that they're loose, then there's no reason not to be loose if that's the way you like to play. But traditional strategy says you shouldn't do that.
Yeah, but you're going to – I mean, the good thing about a game like this is you're going to get paid off with your decent hands at a rate that you're not going to get paid off from those hands in a game with good players.
True.
But that makes sense,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, yeah.
So, I mean, people are going to say, well, I can't just sit around and wait for good cards. Well, you don't have to wait for good cards. You just have to recognize that you're probably going to make some money on top pair, top kicker in this game where you might not get the 1-2 over a pallet or something.
Right, and I don't know if they're paying them off either. I know that they're opening with, but I don't know if they're actually paying them off either. So, like I said, if I were going to compete with complete strangers and I noticed right away they're real loose, then I might tighten up just because it's harder for you, too, if you're an average player and you're sitting down at a game to, you know, if it's hard enough as it is to beat the game, and then you have to try to put them on hands, and you can't put them on hands because they're loose. So if you're going to have to play loose players and you can't really know how they play just yet, you're going to want to go in there with a big hand. So that's why I would tighten up.
Yeah, and I'll tell you the other thing. A game like this makes it a lot easier to play, like, jacks, tens, jacks, queens, kings.
Yeah, yeah.
Because you know if an ace or an overcard comes, you're probably dead.
Yeah.
You know, so get out.
Yeah.
A lot less guessing in that sense. All right, so on to the actual hand. It's about the fourth hand of a two-table tourney, 16 players. Bought it for $45 and got 8,500 in chips. And everyone is still within a couple hundred of a starting amount. Blinds are still 50.
25-50, okay.
All right. Our hero is in the cutoff seat, and the villain, who is under the gun, plus two, opens for 150, and we look down to find two black jacks.
Nice. Okay, well, here's the deal. We just talked ad nauseum about, you know, hey, these guys can open up with just about anything, and under gun plus two is almost middle position, really. So it is middle position, really, because you count the blinds in the early position. So I would have no problem re-raising here. And since I got almost 9,000 in chips, you know, making it 500 to go is certainly acceptable.
All right. What I find most interesting about this right now is he gave us all this talk about how he knows there's a lot of loose play, and then he gives us a hand all the way from the fourth hand of the tournament.
That's true.
So how much has he picked up in the first three hands already? Well, revisionist history, I think, is ahead of us here. All right. Well, yeah. Normally, I would raise as well too. But obviously, we have some information from the future, I believe.
Yeah.
In the opening here, and if that's the case, you know what? I'm gonna treat jacks like a set mining opportunity. As bad as that sounds, but in a loose game like this, you know, I'm worried about a queen, a king, or an ace going. Whereas in a better game, I'm not so worried about that many cards coming. So I might limp along here.
Oh,
feel free to fillet me.
Well, capital U, capital G, capital H. I think that's a horrible play.
All right.
And I understand, well, we can always flash back to Daniel Grano and his 2-10s thing. But we're talking about this guy's opening under the gun plus 2 for 150. Whether it's revisionist history or not, you still have to, you know, they say there's no right way to play Jack, so what the hell.
Right.
But I have to thin the field here. I mean, if they're that crazy, Any card that comes that's over,
well, that's
can be in anyone's calling range. If we're just limping along, and you're giving with one limper, one raise, and then a caller, you're giving the blinds the odds to call, and then other guys might want to just come along too, or they may squeeze, you know what I mean? And at that point, then you don't know where you are. I have to raise. I'm sorry. There's no way I'm limping with jacks here.
You said you were raising to 500?
Yep.
Wow. Big bet.
Well, this 150 was the raise, so three times that's 450. Why not make it five? And
no, but again, I think you're playing normal.
Yeah, I'm a normal guy.
Loose home game, yeah, yeah. I don't think there's anything normal about you, buddy.
Well, still, if they're loose, I don't want a ton of action either, so I want to make sure that they're
But my point is that if it's a loose game, you got 8,500 chips, I don't think these players are going to recognize what you're doing, and I think you have a very good chance of still getting callers, even at ridiculous 10 times the blind raise now.
Well, you're doing revisionist history. I mean, we're four hands in. He said they're loose. We didn't say they were idiots. I mean, I don't know.
No, but I mean, if you're talking about, you know, opening with weak aces and king jacks and betting second pairs on the flops really strong, these are the type of people. I mean, think about it. We're going to do a poker 101 class tonight, right?
Yeah.
And I guarantee you if we do our labs like we always do, there are going to be people that somebody's going to raise to 500 and there's going to be like four callers. They're going to look down and go, hey, I've got a purple chip. I'll call. And I'm not making fun of them.
No, just, I know.
We've all been there. We all started there. So that would be my only worry. I think you're playing a sound game of poker with your raise of 500. I just worry whether it's actually big enough to do what you want to with this type of player. And you're right. I mean, we're only four hands in. We're just using the information we have. But you know, I think when you think about raising to thin the field, which is what you're trying to do, you have to take into account the likelihood that you actually are going to thin the field.
Okay, well, I don't know what he does, but if he raises like me, we'll see what happens, and if he calls like you, we'll see what happens. So we'll see who gets bit on the ass here.
Throwing down the gauntlet. All right, well, our hero is very, very smart, Chris. He says he still has three people to act and doesn't want to build a big pot only to be frozen by overcards or coordinator board on the flop, so he just calls.
Oh.
Round of applause.
Yeah, okay.
No, I'm joking.
We'll see. Here's the thing.
But you said the absolutely best thing is there really is no way to play, a good way to play jacks. I don't think that's kings or ace magnets. You know, that's BS. They're not really. But I really do believe that jacks are the most difficult hand to play.
Yeah, and it's hard because, you know, even if you had kings or aces, if you're going by your theory, a raise isn't going to make a difference. Let's say you had aces. Would you have raised with aces? What's the difference? They're still going to get five callers and still have to go up against 10 cards on a flop. You know what I mean? So, really, does it make a difference if it's jacks here, if you're not raising with them?
I think it does make it a little difference. I mean, I'd be far more confident going against 10 people with aces than I would with 10 people with jacks.
All right, so let's say you have jacks and you raised and they all call and it comes all unders. How is that any different than if you raised with aces and they all called and it comes with all unders?
That's not different at all, but the difference is what if a king comes? With pocket aces, I'm not so worried about the king. Yeah. With jacks, I am.
No, I know. I'm just saying
small
that both
difference.
I'm talking about the unders. You know, if this flop now comes all
I'm
unders.
I'm hoping to get the unders either way, but if I knew the flop was going to be all unders, yeah, I'd be raising to 500 here. I haven't developed my game to the point now where I can read the flop before it comes out, though.
Well, the other thing, too, is not every single player at this table isn't going to respect the raise. That's why I wanted to raise. But, okay, he calls. Yeah. We'll see what happens.
All right. Yeah, we'll see that we're right and you're wrong. All right, the button and small blind also call. And what interesting, he's putting them on ranges, Chris.
Wow.
Ace X hands, pairs, and paint hands. But, of course, you know, from what he told us, that seems what people are playing anyhow. So.
Well, to me, if that's what the range he's putting them on, then those are actually hands of sound ABC poker. I mean, if you're only calling a raise with a pair or paint hands or an ace, that's pretty decent. That's not loose. You know what I mean? So it's kind of contradictory to me.
All right. Well, the pot is 650 now, and the flop is the jack of diamonds, six of spades, ace of clubs, and our hero goes cowabunga, California version of bingo bango.
Oh, man.
A little upset that Ricky Tiki Tavi hasn't taken off.
We're working on it. I think it's huge in the UK, so.
It could be.
All right, so you already messed up the hand because you needed to go the ace of clubs.
I'm sorry.
Jack of diamonds, spades for that one listener who wants to hear them in the right order. So
right. Ace of clubs, jack of spades, jack of diamonds, six of spades.
All okay.
Right. Rainbow board, ace high. We have a set. Small blind checks. The villain, who remember was the initial raiser, bets 375 into our pot of 650, and it is on us.
Okay. Well, we've flopped a set. We've set mine. We've hit our set.
I'm not really confident with my set, to be honest.
Well, I mean, you know, really, you're only losing the one hand, yep. And, you know, the guy doesn't have a set of aces. He just doesn't. So, if he bets 375, here's the thing, is you're hoping to God he has ace-king, mm-hmm. and then you raise here. This is why when you flop a set, you want to bet into the pre-flop raiser traditionally. Now, this isn't a traditional table, but if the guy is raising pre-flop and then betting that flop, you have to assume he has an ace, or at least hope he has an ace. And if either way, you're winning a pretty decent pot early on anyway. So I would raise here. I wouldn't just call. I realize there's no real draws out there, but there, if they're calling with the paint like he said, or if he's calling with an ace rag and has aces up, you're giving him his price to hit that six on the turn and make a boat bigger than your jack. So, you know, if he has ace six, it wouldn't be bigger. If he had an ace on the turn, then have a bigger boat. So,
or a ten or queen for
For Broadway. So that's what I'm saying. So really, I don't want to let him dictate it. I want to take control of the hand now. I'm virtually in position. I know there's still the button left to act, but I need to raise here. I should have raised preflop really to narrow the field because there's so many people in the hand now. But since we've hit our set, I don't think calling is a good play here. I think we should raise to like 1200.
Okay.
Maybe 1100.
I am going to absolutely agree with you for the second time this show.
Wow. Well, no, you defended me on one. Now you're agreeing
okay,
on another.
Right.
You know, the other one, defense thing, you know. But all right, so good. You agree we should at least now
I'll tell
raise.
You, I will be real tempted, though, to call. And the reason is, while the board does look pretty safe, you know, we're talking about people playing king jacks and king queens and stuff. I think it's a little more dangerous than it normally would be. And the reason I'd be tempted to call is that I think I've got a really strong hand here compared to what normally people would be playing. And if I could rope in the button and the small blind as well, too, I might end up making more money on this hand than if I just try to isolate against the one guy who probably has an ace and will probably pay us off. But all that being said, the small blind checked, so maybe it's a check raise, but I'm not really sensing that. So we only have one other player behind us that we might get money out of.
Yeah.
So at that point, I think I'm fine just not taking a chance and going heads up with this guy who, again, I really do think has an ace and is probably going to pay us off as long as we put in a reasonable raise. And I probably would put in 1,000 just because it's a nice clean. Okay. Hey, I've got a yellow chip or whatever it is.
Just make sure you say raise before you throw it in there.
Yeah, yeah. But, you know, I'm not opposed to 1,200 or 1,100 or 1,699 if that's possible.
All right, well, let's see what happens because both you and I say we should raise, so.
All right, well, our hero decides to just call, partly to see what happens with the button and the small blind with the intention to drop the hammer with a blank on the turn. See, the problem there is you're counting on a blank on a turn.
Yeah, plus, you know what else, too? Aggressive play wins in poker. And right now, he's just being passive and allowing people to dictate the action. You know, he started with me right off from the beginning. I really think he should have raised preflop. And if he did, he probably would have got callers. Now he's hit his set with a bunch of callers. And aggressive poker wins. And I think here, he needs to be aggressive. Just calling along is giving people outs to hit. So, I don't... You know, at their cost. So I don't like that at all. I do want to see a raise and hope this guy has ace-king.
All right, well, he says the button folds, and surprisingly, the small blind calls.
Wow.
Puts him on an ace at the best, but feel he's weak because of the pre-flop call. I think I can narrow down a little bit here. I, based on what we know here, the small blind probably does have a weak ace.
Yeah.
There's only 375. Hey, I'll call that. Maybe I'll hit my second pair.
Yeah.
And again, we're hoping the other guy does have a higher ace, but you know,
You know, and there are, and like you said, it's a loose. If it's as loose as he says it is, then you know, there could be draws out there. It could be broadways out there that just 375 is nothing when you have $9,000 in front of you, and maybe you'll hit the miracle gut shot or something on you. So you never know. But really, right now, you got a hammer lock on his hand.
Yeah, and if it's not a king or queen or ten on the turn, then I'm feeling really good and.
Drop
try to extract as much as I can.
Yeah.
All right, well, the turn pot is now 1775, and the turn is the five of hearts. So our board now is ace of clubs, jack of diamonds, six of spades, five of hearts.
That's
a
sweet
card. Really excited about this.
Yeah, that's a sweet card because that's four suits, so there's no flush ever coming. Yep. That really, no one's going to be in the hand with a 7-8 hoping to hit a straight on the end. You know, so that's a real good card for us.
And maybe somebody had pocket fives or sticking around, and, you know.
Yeah, I doubt it.
No, I don't. But
oh, and even then, you're still ahead, so it doesn't matter. Yeah.
But they're really, I can't imagine a scenario where this card is bad for us right now.
Yeah, no, there's no way.
All right, the small blind checks, big blind bets 1,200.
Well, I still don't put this guy on a set of aces, so, I mean, it sounds like ace is up. He could have the case jack in his hand with an ace, could have aces and sixes. It really feels like ace is up or ace king. Because ace king wouldn't be really afraid of anything here either.
No.
And that's a healthy bet. I mean, that's, you know, three quarters of the pot or whatever. So, I think I'm going to put the hammer down now and shove. I mean, I would normally raise here. That's 3,600. You know, I only started with 85, and I called 300 and 150, 400. So, really, I mean, just calling that bet, I want to raise it. Raising is going to be more than 50% of my stack. I think I'm shoving here. I realize it's the fourth hand, but, God, I got a set of jacks, and I'm only losing the one hand. And if this guy has a set of aces, you know, whatever. You know, it's set over set, and you're going to lose your money that way. So, I'm shoving here.
Yeah. Wow. You make some good points. I'm worried that my shove is going to be too much. You know, if he's got ace king, I don't think he's going to call the shove. But you're right. I don't know really. I mean, I guess at this point, I'm not too worried about what I'm leaving behind. You know, I'm hoping maybe he's unsophisticated and doesn't realize that. And, you know, maybe if I min raise, I squeeze another 1200 out of him and get a little bit more. Maybe a little bit more, but 2000. I don't know. To me, a shove seems like too much. Right now, I think I can get more out of him by betting a little less.
Yeah, I don't know.
And by the betting here, I'm not. Well, yeah, by the betting now, I'm not worried about the king 10, queen 10, you know, those kind of cards anymore now. I really do think we're up against some aces. And you're right, it could be set of aces in that case, you know. That's just bad luck.
Yeah, it's just poker.
That's just variance catching up to us. I'm sorry.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I just don't trust these players.
Well, the other thing, let me ask you the other thing, too, is at this point, we have one card left to come that could be scary. And really, just by the way the action's going, I think I'm dismissing the fact that that card could be scary now. So should we not try to focus now on trying to get what we can get out of the small blind here?
God, I don't know if I want to keep another hand in. I mean, 1,200 is pretty substantial. I don't think a drawing hand sticking around for that, but you never know. The hands I'm really afraid of are aces up and then an ace coming on the river. That's my biggest fear right now.
I gotcha. Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, again...
But if that's the case, that's a two-outer.
No, I know. And I'm not playing to, you know... I'm just thinking that I got somebody who's willing to keep firing at me on the hook. I at some point, have a feeling that one of these guys is going to drop out. And if I just call and he drops out, then I'm losing a bet there, I feel like. I feel like the guy who fired at me has a pretty big hand. And I feel like if that's the case,
well,
I can
get more
out of him.
If you're going to shove now, what's the risk in waiting to the calling or doing a smaller race here to try to get small blind, knowing that you're going to shove regardless of what happens?
No, that's fine. I mean, I just felt like if I'm going to raise, I usually would raise more than the minimum. And if I did that, then I'm competing more than 50% of my stack, and you know that dictates I should probably just shove anyway. But yeah, you're right. I mean,
my point is, I don't think we're missing a bet.
Yeah,
here.
No. I mean, if you just call, you're missing
stacks,
a bet. You're saying to try to keep the small blind in. That's how I think you can miss a bet. If you just call and the small blind folds.
No, but I mean, you're going to shove anyhow. So let's say we just call and even the small blind folds. Whatever happens on the river, you're shoving, right?
Well, I'm just trying to dissuade you from wanting to just call here.
Okay, but what I'm saying is I think this is a situation where I don't think it really matters because we're going to get the money in on the river anyhow.
Well, not necessarily. You know, I mean, I don't know if you are. You don't have to shove on the river now. If he checks to you on the river and you just called and fortunately got the small blind to fold, then you could find an amount that doesn't have to be a shove. You know, I mean, I don't think you have to shove on the river now. You shove here to isolate because you can get this guy to call with one card to come. I wouldn't shove on the river just to blindly shove. That's when you want to extract if he checks to you. Hmm. You know what I mean? You don't know what he's going to do on the river. You're thinking about the river already, and he hasn't even made move to make me shove.
I don't know. I'm just saying, you know, if he bets on the river, we're getting it in, and he calls. So at this point, I'm just trying to find the way to max. We're both trying to find a way to maximize the most value.
Right. Well, I just wasn't sure if you were going to say call here, because calling here, I think, is how you can miss some money. Because then if you call and the small blind folds, now on the river the guy checks to you, and then you make a bet, he may fold when he doesn't make his hand or whatever. He may get scared, but if you shove here, you
exactly.
might get the call.
Exactly, and that's what we're trying to analyze here. I mean, is this small blind a weak ace that's willing to call 1,200? If he or she is, that helps.
Yeah.
If we're looking across the table and he or she is disinterested at this point, so it's probably going to fold even to the call, then yeah, we should raise.
Yeah.
It's tough for us to say by reading an email which way it is. But what I'm saying is if I think I can get that small blind to call the 1,200, I would much rather do that than raise and isolate here when I'm going to be able to, you know, get the stack in on the river if need be. That's the only reason I would think about calling.
Yeah, I hear you. I just, I don't know. Maybe I'm just afraid of too many monsters. You know, I think if somebody's got A6, somebody has Ace-Jack, you know, we could be looking at, you know,
yeah,
two
but then, you're down to a one-outer to lose his hand.
Yeah, I know.
Unless,
yeah,
you know. So, yeah. I mean, at this point, I'm really not worried about anything on the board coming. I mean, I really think I've got this hand won. At this point, I just need to figure out how to win the most chips out of it.
Yeah. Well, if I put the guy on Ace-King or even Ace-6, then I'm definitely raising the first better because I know he's not going to fold that hand, Ace-6.
No.
And if he has Ace-Jack, he's not folding Ace-Jack to a raise. So, you know, the odds of them both having aces up or an ace that's enough to call the small blind to, I don't think it's going to happen. I think really I have one hand here that's good enough to call, and that's why I would raise.
All right. So our hero puts some either on a set of aces, or our villain on a set of aces where he's crushed, or aces up and he's well ahead. So he decides to isolate on the villain and raises to 3,000. That leaves him a little over 4,000 behind, he says.
Hmm. Well, that's not too bad. As long as, you know, that's not 50% of his stack, and that's like 2.5 times, so that's a pretty good bet there. And you know, like I said, I forget the effective stacks, because he said we got 8,500. I don't know if that's how many he has. But yeah, that's about right. So that sounds pretty good, too. That leaves you some chips, some weird feeling on the river. You know, I don't know what will get me to fold now, but
well, yeah, but I mean, we're talking about shoving. We're talking about a raise to 3,000 versus a raise to 7,000.
Yeah,
and how that plays out. I mean, a fourth hand of the tournament. Remember, people, even a weaker player, I don't think is willing to go to the mat with Ace King on this kind of board for a stack on the fourth hand of the tournament.
Yeah,
I mean, I guess that's why I was thinking the shove right now seemed a little excessive. I mean, 3,000, that's almost a 3x raise there. And
yeah.
Still leaves the person half their stack behind. So, you know, if they're not sure, I mean, we're trying to put the doubt in our opponent's mind here. I don't really have any doubt on my own.
Yeah, 3,000 is a good bet. I mean, like I said, I was thinking 3,600, which is more than half then, but 3,000 isn't. It's a little less than half, and that's a pretty good bet. I think I like that bet. And if maybe when we were playing and I saw the chips in front of me and I actually knew what the stack was, maybe that's probably the bet I might have focused on and not shoved to get more out of them. But even so, I just don't like a call there on the turn. I really don't. So I like the raise. So that's a good amount. I agree with that.
Okay. The small blind folds and the villain calls, which is just what our hero said he wanted.
Sure.
And the pot is now $7,765 going to the river, which is the king of clubs. So our final board is ace of clubs, jack of diamonds, six of spades, five of hearts, king of clubs. So that weird Broadway got there, but I think we've already discounted that. And if he's got Ace-King, this is a beautiful card for us.
Yeah, that's sweet if he has Ace-King.
And even better, the villain bets 3,800.
Oh, my God. Man.
A little over 4,000. I imagine he's about the same, so maybe he was saving bus fare.
Is it a set of kings? Oh, my God. I mean, how can he still be betting here without having us be beat? Oh my
well,
God.
Well, yeah, if he's got Ace King, I mean, nothing changes. This is, you know, exactly what we'd expect. Now, you're right. I mean, I think we, in our discussions on the turn, we did discount the fact that, you know, if he has queens or kings that, you know, he could outset us on the river. But again, that's, you know,
yeah,
very few outs to really worry about.
Jeez. Well, I don't think I'm good enough. The way this hand goes, I'm not good enough to fold a set of jacks here. I'm just not. I mean, it could be a set of aces, you know, and he set us up by saying they're really loose. Or he could be dead on. It could be queen 10, you know. I mean, how could queen 10 play this hand this way? And a set of kings could play the hand this way. Ace king could play the hand this way. So now you're back to your coin flip. You know, is it 50-50?
I'm less likely to put him on kings, knowing what we know about the table, though. But you're right, it could be.
I mean, it could be. If he's loose, he can keep betting it that way.
I would think that person would probably slow down on the turn if he had kings and he had two callers with an ace.
Yeah.
High board. I would probably think one or the two of them has an ace and just slow down and hope I can check the river. And so I can't imagine he's betting out with kings with that kind of action. So, I'm not worried here, I guess. I think I got the best hand, and, you know, he's put me essentially all in. Maybe I'll just, you know, I'll get the nation riled up and say I'll just call here and save the 200 in case I'm wrong.
Yeah, but, I mean, whenever I have in front of me, he's getting in.
Yeah, I'm not scared. So,
yeah, if I lose this hand, I'll be shocked. But I'm it is hand of the week, so I'm putting it all in though.
All right. Well, we call showing our set of jacks. The villain turns over. Queen of clubs. Ten of clubs.
Oh, no way. That's a made-up hand. That didn't happen. How does Queen 10 play that hand that way the whole way? There's no way. That's a made-up hand, man. I'm calling you out, buddy.
I'm calling you out.
Queen 10. Were you playing Scott Long in this home game and you didn't tell me?
I don't think I played Queen 10 in 5 years.
You love that hand.
It's an old wise tale.
All right, so let's look at this real quick. The guy raised under the gun plus two with Queen 10.
Made a crappy raise.
If we had re-raised, maybe the Queen 10 goes away. I don't know.
Are you sure? I mean, here's the thing. This guy, he raised with Queen 10 from under the gun plus two. Already a weak play. Flop comes with an ace. Now, I realize that we have a gut shot then. Woo! But that's not the flop we wanted to see when we're getting frisky with our queen 10. Bets gets two callers. And then a five of hearts comes, which doesn't help us at all. It doesn't even give us an extra club for a club draw. And we keep firing that barrel and get called again. Wow.
All right, well, let's take the hand from my perspective. Okay, we raise pre-flop.
I don't think that kind of guy folds queen 10.
You raise pre-flop. Okay, if he calls again, that's fine. Now, like I said, if he calls, you're putting him on an ace. Not the queen 10, but you're putting him on the ace. Flop comes with your set. Now he bets again. Now you make the raise that I said earlier, not calling with the jacks.
Sure.
Now, if you make a substantial raise here, can he really call? And if he does, okay, he calls. Then on the turn, you shove. Can he really call a shove with a gut shot? No. If you play it the way I play it, you have your whole stack and a bunch of his chips. You play it the way he played it, and you're out of the tournament.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you very much.
But in general, though.
Thanks for calling. Thanks for playing this week.
But no, I mean, I'm going to play the role of Gundam here. You're getting results-oriented here in this one hand. You know, in general, I want this guy playing like this every time.
Sure, sure. But again, you also don't want
to
keep playing.
Draw to get to it.
You don't want
to
play in a way that helps him either. You know, I'm not being results-oriented. I'm telling you, if you play it our way, this is how you improve. Screw the results-oriented crap I'm hearing all the time. We're still trying to educate these people on how to play the hands. And really, I think that a re-raise pre-flop and then a raise again after the flop gets the job done. And if it does it on the turn, a shove certainly does.
All right, well, let me ask you this. All right, so if you play it the way you did, you raise the pre-flop, you isolate against that guy, right?
Mm-hmm.
You flop your set with an ace on the board, he bets, you raise him again, and he folds. You're happy?
Sure.
You're happy.
Sure, I'm happy. I've got a re-raise in pre-flop, got some decent chips there. I get a bet and a raise. I get a call. If I get a call there, that's cool. But if I don't, I've still got, you know, a decent – this is the fourth hand of a tournament, 25-50, and I've just increased my stack by a good 10% on one hand. maybe more. I'm not trying to win the tournament in one hand because I can't. There's other guys still playing.
No,
so
I'm not trying to win
pots.
The tournament in one hand. I'm just saying this is an opportunity where I would like to increase my stack by more than 10%. Now, I'm not going to be upset increasing it by only 10%. It's a lot better than the what we saw here, you know, increasing it by negative 100%. But I don't know. I just don't think that with what we know about this, with that kind of flop, that I'm interested in ending it on the flop. I would like to extract a little more value out of him and get another bet out of him on the turn.
Again, if I get to the turn and he calls with that gut shot, or if he calls and I think he has the ace, still on the turn, I'm still winning this hand. It's over on the turn. He's not calling with the gut shot on the turn. If he's got ace reg or ace two aces up, we're still winning a ton of money because he's going to call the
all still in. Getting more money out of him, though, rather than shutting him down on the flop.
Well, again, you have to put the guy on hands at some point right. After a flop in a bet.
And I'm putting him on an ace.
Right, so I think a raise isn't going to make him fold on the flop. If he has ace-king, he's not going to fold if you raise.
Okay.
You know, if you're putting him on an ace guy and you then you then
I know,
you
but
have
you're saying
him.
You're fine if he does.
I'm fine if he folds. That's a decent win. But if he doesn't, you put him on an ace, I'm still going to raise. I'm not going to call there. You know what I mean? You called with the set of jacks earlier.
But I mean, you know, let's let him hang himself one more time. If he's got an ace, he's going to bet the turn. He's not going to slow down.
Maybe. Or if he, you know, I don't know. Either way, let's say he doesn't have an ace and then
he
checks.
I'd like to
bet
get
the turn?
One more bet and a turn on this guy. On
well,
this
I think
if I get a river bet out of him too, that's
see, I think you're wrong. I think you're 100% wrong there. I think if he doesn't have an ace, he's not going to bet, and you're going to lose. If he does have
an
ace...
But he's not going to call my raise on the flop either, so there's nothing lost there.
If he has an ace, and then you on the turn, he's going to check on the turn. If he has an ace, that's naked. And then you're going to bet, and then he's going to think about it. You know what I mean? I don't think you're going to get...
But how does that change if we raise on the flop? If he doesn't have a hand that he can bet the turn with, he's not going to call your raise on the flop, so it doesn't matter. What I'm saying is if he has a hand that he can call a raise on the flop, that means he's got a hand that he's going to bet out again on the turn, and that's another bet that I can get out of him before I raise.
But you're getting the bet on the flop.
Not if he doesn't call it.
He just said if he has a hand that can call, you're going to get in a turn.
All right, well, if he calls, but then he checks because we raised him again. So now we bet one more time, and maybe he decides, you know what, it's the fourth hand, I'm going to fold here. But if we leave him in the driver's seat, he's going to make that bet again. So it's just a matter of whether that bet on the turn is more money than what we're raising and getting him to call on the flop.
Yeah. And then you're also
it's really probably 51-49. But
yeah,
I'm
you're
sure
forgetting the other player, too. There's another player in the hand still at that point earlier on. So I don't know. I think that we play it where you're aggressive. You take the hand down. You have a big, decent pot, and you move on. Now you're out of the tournament. You didn't play it aggressively. You played it passively all the way to almost the end. And that's tough to... It's tough to do because you're letting people catch up. And if they are true maniacs or loose players, you have to put Queen 10 as a range here then, I guess. I don't know. But I can't believe he had Queen 10. That's just crazy.
Well, of course not. All right, TJ, we appreciate you sending in. And we also appreciate the fact that you loved your PMS Pokerware t-shirt that we sent you recently. So, you know, no more swags coming your way. But everybody else, send your hand of the week to podcast@antiupmagazine.com. And don't forget... You might win something great like an uncut sheet of J-Design playing cards, official playing cards of Anti-Up. And remember, you can only win the uncut sheets on the show by sending us stuff in, but you can definitely buy those cards at the Anti-Up store at antiupstore.com.
Well, I want to thank Elliot Schechter for being on this week's show. Brilliant guy. Way smarter than us. Nice place he's got out there.
It's not saying much.
But he's still smarter. Yeah. I'm Chris Cosenza.
And I'm Scott Long.
We'll see you at the table.
Anti Up is a production of AntiUpMagazine.com and is recorded at WDAE 620 AM in Tampa. Contact us at podcast@AntiUpMagazine.com or call our hotline at 813-448-1120. If you'd like to advertise, send us an email at advertising@AntiUpMagazine.com or call 727-331-4335. Some music used in this episode comes courtesy of the PodSafe Music Network.